Sip, savor, and experience 408 sakes and 16 restaurants at the Joy of Sake on September 16th. Go to joyofsake.com for an evening of sake perfection.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively and partially Groundworks Inc.
I just feel singly, like, sometimes.
Individually. But we're really not all of Groundworks. There's another part of Groundworks.
There's a whole team.
A whole team working today out in the gardens.
They make the magic happen.
They do. And we design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring the culture to horticulture. And it's so nice to be back in the studio.
It is. It's nice that the weather has cooled down a little bit.
It broke finally.
And we're in the September back-to-school mode.
It is. I know. It kind of happens like... So September is kind of like bittersweet. It's like my birthday month.
Uh-huh.
And it's the start of school, which mm-hmm. when I was a kid, I was equally like nauseous and excited. I was excited.
The anxiety.
The anxiety and like, yeah, you're going to be seeing the same people. And yet... You know,
different.
You just everyone's changed a little.
Well, and you have to get up early, and those like lazy long days of lounging around are done.
But you kind of like it. Like,
yeah,
you kind of want an end,
good thing.
You know?
Yeah.
So now my life doesn't revolve around school schedule so much.
Mine does.
Yes, exactly. You're in the thick of it.
I am in pre-K hell.
And I'm in like last year of high school hell.
Yeah.
But I also, you know, but he's kind of, you know, he's doing his own thing. But it's still, September still symbolizes like the beginning mm-hmm. of the new year.
Renewal.
You know, renewal, yeah. Et cetera. So Alice and I, this September, are embarking on some exciting new projects. But before we get into that, kind of wanted to recap the gardening season a little bit to kind of highlight a point about farming and gardening that we're going to delve into a little bit later in the show. So weather-wise, it was a hot, dry summer in New York.
Yeah.
According to New York State's own statistics, New York City and the Hudson Valley are in a mild drought. But there are large parts of Western New York that are under severe drought.
Yeah.
Now, these are agricultural regions. There's winemaking regions out there, the Finger mm-hmm. Lakes, et cetera. And, you know, of course, everybody knows about the record-breaking California drought.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you're a farmer or a gardener, you might not have noticed the lack of rain that much in New York. You turn on the tap and the water still comes out, right? So you're not really focused on it. But as gardeners and garden builders, we pay attention to the weather. We have to. Our livelihood depends on it, but our lives don't depend on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, so with the excessive heat and the lack of rain, some plants struggled, of course, but most of the gardens we built have irrigation systems, which, as long as they're functioning, could keep the plants reasonably alive. Now, a farmer may or may not have the luxury of as much water as he wants, mm-hmm. and if he does, he may not be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So like in California, a lot of almond farmers just stopped growing almonds. You know, they let the fields go fallow. So also, you know, when I think about farming, I always think about acts of God, right? Like, because we're just at the mercy of that, right?
Yeah.
So this season was also filled with accidents and illnesses.
Talk about a test.
Yes. Yeah. That affected our team and as a consequence, our work. Food poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
Car accidents,
uh-huh.
dog attacks,
uh-huh.
and most tragically, one of our team members, you know, had a friend who committed suicide.
Right.
You know, so those are like stuff that happens.
Right.
You can't plan for that. It's, you know, and so, you know, I'm not bringing this up to complain, but to illustrate a point about farming. In a way, Alice and I are small scale farmers in kind of, you know, indirectly. Our work
mm-hmm.
is seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
It's physical.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with living things, and there's this narrow margin between success and failure.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a thin line.
It is.
You know?
Yep.
So for this year, for our special project, I decided, and Alice decided, we're going to become small-scale farmers of a sort, right? So we grew tobacco, cotton, and rice in my backyard in Brooklyn. And we're going to share about experiences growing these uncommon plants on the show today. And these plants are the centerpiece of a special project called The Garden of Discovery, Seven Plants with Strange Tales to Tell, which opens later this month in Brooklyn, right outside Alice's Brooklyn Row House. So this, with this project, Alice and I wanted to take our audio work on the show with We Dig Plants and make it tangible, make a garden that included some of the plants and people that we've talked about on the show for years, and give people a kind of an opportunity to see, touch, and learn about these interesting plants. So we chose them based on their beauty, their historical importance, and also their great backstories. So I'm going to talk about the economic plants, the rice, starting with cotton, actually. So we had done a few years back an entire series on economic botany, and cotton was included, and we did an entire show on cotton. So I'm not going to revisit that and talk about, you know, cotton's history, but I want to talk about growing it in New York. It's kind of weird, you know? So the cotton plants were these tiny little plugs. I think, Alice, you ordered them from the Cotton Man.
The Cotton Man, right? Down in New Bern, North Carolina.
Okay, so cotton is strange. So these little cotton plants came in May with like these 1-inch little root balls, and I quickly repotted them into these like quart size grow pots. And I use it just if anybody wants to recreate this. This is what I did, and it worked well. I used a mix of a soil called Metro Mix 510 and compost. So it was like a really rich soil, because I imagined like cotton growing down south and pretty like good soil, you know, and wanting a lot of nutrients to grow well. So these plants were like pretty slow growing at first. They really didn't put out any new growth. They just were kind of like, they seemed to be like static. I knew that they needed heat to like really get growing. Alice was like, you just got to wait till it gets hot. Like, they're going to do it. They're going to do it. So, and then I decided, you know, we have to do it organically to try to mimic the way that farmers did it historically. So I only used organic fertilizers. I used fish and kelp-based liquid fertilizers from Neptune's Harvest, which worked very well. And so I just gave them that like once a week. So then the cotton plants did something really interesting at night. They folded their leaves. It was weird. I'd never seen that. And at first I thought they were in wilt. I was like, oh, give them more water.
But then they don't like. They like to be dry.
Exactly. Right. So then I quickly realized what was happening. I was like, okay. So it took these little plants about a month to like really start putting on new leaves.
And let's just say they didn't even send these plants to us until like the second or the third week of June.
May. Because I started them in May. Yeah, I kept a whole diary of it. I planted them like May 22nd is when I planted them.
Okay.
So they were slow.
And we were worried about the frost, though.
Yes, exactly.
We were very worried about the frost.
And they weren't even pots. They were
frost just date here in New York is
May 15th.
May 15th.
Yeah.
Right.
So May 22nd is when I like started them. So they were like kind of moving along. Then they got attacked by this like small light colored insect, which I kind of like dealt with what I sprayed them. And then I sprayed them with neem oil, and then they didn't have any more problems. Cause I was like, I don't even know what attacks them. I'm going to have like boll weevils. Like I had no idea what to expect. This is a Brooklyn backyard, you know, and everything's in pots. So then by early July, the cotton was knee high. And then by the end of July, they were in bloom. Cause I was like, are they going to bloom? You know, is it going to be hot enough? And they have this like amazing bright white satiny flower that only lasts like a day or two. And then it fades and turns to pink. And then at the end of July, I got bigger pots and I cleaned and sterilized these grow pots and I transplanted them in a couple of stages into bigger pots. Cause like these guys have got to have more room to,
they get big.
So they all were exactly the same. There was no diversity except for this one oddball that had completely different leaves, which I thought was
always an oddball.
There was an oddball. It's kind of, I like the oddball, you know,
I'm the oddball.
Exactly. So, anyway, I was stressing a lot about this cotton. Right. And then I kept thinking about slavery. Like every time I like watered them and cared for them, I kept thinking about like, it just has
this
such
is
a
the crop.
This is the crop. It has such a strong connotation, you know? And I kept thinking about how they had to be cultivated and harvested thousands of acres at a time, you know, and here I am like stressing about like 12 pots, you know? And the plant isn't really pretty. It's kind of...
It is when you see it in a field.
Yes, with lots of flowers.
Yeah, and you see that brown bowl.
Yeah, the bowl. So, but it had this like... I was like, I
but
know,
the leaf is not.
No, it's kind of boring. And yeah. I started like looking into it, and I was like, oh, it looks kind of weird. When the flower is done, there's these like kind of weirdly sinister sepals, and mm-hmm. then you don't see anything. I'm like, where's the bowl going to come out of? Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. but it happened. Mm-hmm. Like it came like within a few days of each flower, there was this green, hard, uh-huh. like lime shaped bowl. And it kept getting bigger and bigger. It was really, really hard. It had these like weird dots on it. Mm-hmm. And then by mid-August, all the cotton plants had the bowls hanging off of them, mm-hmm. you know, and they got bigger and bigger. And then the plants kind of stopped growing and they were like 2 feet tall. And now the bowls are about the size of a lime. Mm-hmm. So they really are getting ready. Mm-hmm. So in late August, I started acclimating them to the shade because Alice's garden is shadier. And then on September 8th, on my birthday, they were transplanted and they were brought to Park Slope where they're going to be part of the exhibit. And people in New York can see them.
See what cotton really looks like.
See what it looks like.
Yep.
You know? So then I started. So at the same time, I was growing the tobacco. Now, tobacco, Alice and I are very familiar with because we grow the ornamental variety.
Yep.
There's a lot of different types, and those also came mail order, tiny little things. Mm-hmm. But those guys, I knew were going to grow fast, and I put them into like gallon pots right away.
And we got those from Tennessee.
Did they?
The okay. Tobacco came from Tennessee.
So they started growing really, really quick. Same mixture of Metro and compost. And I made it a little heavier on the compost side because I'm like, these guys probably want a lot more water
yeah.
than the cotton. And they doubled in size like in a week. Mm-hmm. They just shot out and they drank a lot. They needed a lot of water. So two of the tobaccos were joined. They were like, I call them the tobacco twins. So I performed surgery on them. I separated them. And then I was like, I don't know if they're going to live, but they both live. So that was really, really fun. And then they got attacked by grasshoppers, you know? And I was like, where the heck are these grasshoppers coming from? I've never seen them in my garden. And I thought that was really weird because I thought of all the plants, that would be the one that wouldn't be attacked because nicotine dust
right.
is an insect repellent. People right. have been using it as an insect repellent for generations. So mm-hmm. why would... So obviously I had like grasshoppers with a nicotine addiction.
Yeah.
So like no matter how much I sprayed them, they kept coming back.
Yep.
So finally I like moved the plants to like a whole other section of the garden. And I guess the grasshoppers didn't find them because they were no longer being bitten. But they took giant bites out of these tobacco plants. So, and the tobacco, unlike the cotton, each plant was very unique mm-hmm. in its habit and its shape. And like one was really gnarly and twisted. So there was like a lot more diversity in the individual mm-hmm. tobacco plants, but they're doing great. They're huge. They haven't bloomed yet, but maybe they will, you yeah. know?
And I don't know if anyone's ever seen it, but when you drive through the South and you see these huge harvested tobacco leaves.
They're huge.
They're 4, 5, 6 feet in length.
Yeah.
And so we'll see what they do here.
They're big, but they're also pots, you
yeah,
know.
And they're not going to get as big as that because we just don't have the length of heat that the South does.
Yeah. And we didn't want to do it in the garden because we thought if they have to be transplanted, containerized yeah. would be...
In fact,
you know,
Atlanta, I was just looking at the Weather Channel yesterday. Atlanta yesterday was having its 80th day
above
of 90 and above
yeah.
weather. So,
and it's the same thing in Italy. They grow tobacco... very well.
Yeah.
And they're massive.
Right.
But it's
right.
really interesting to grow it.
It's fun to
you know?
See it. Yeah.
And your grandpa grew tobacco.
My grandpa was a sharecropper, a tobacco sharecropper. Yeah. And my father kept saying, I was telling him in the winter about this project, and yeah. he kept saying, it's never going to work. It's never going to work. And it is working, not to the degree that it would be.
Are we
going to
smoke the tobacco leaves? Well,
are we going to eat the rice?
Well, we're going to talk about
yeah,
that next
yeah.
because we did grow rice.
Are we going to make a t-shirt out of the cotton?
I don't know. We might have some nice bowls to arrange in a vase, because those are like the de rigueur New York floral florist, you know. So the rice we got from our good friend Bree Glovna in North Carolina. Bree's been on the show a couple of times, and she's starting a whole foodscape revolution from her hometown and spreading it all over.
And she is doing a lot of these ancient grains in her front yard.
So
she's she was kind of the impetus for us to do it.
She really inspired us.
The urban side of her suburban experience.
She has a big suburban plot.
Yeah.
So she sent us three varieties of rice that included one called Kodai Mai, Palmin, and Carolina Gold, which is a heritage variety. She told us to just treat it like an ornamental grass. So I thought the rice would probably be the easiest to grow, you know? So those, I decided that we got those like mid-May, and I planted those end of May, right? And I wanted, because I wanted the weather to warm up a bit, like as Alice said, we were afraid of frost, you know? So I put them in a heavier mixture. I put them in almost all compost because I thought to myself, well, they grow in rice paddies, which are flooded.
Right.
So they want to really stay wet.
Yeah.
So I put 3 or 4 clumps in a 5 or 7 gallon pot. And if people don't know what that means, that's just like, that's how the nursery defines pots as a measure of volume. But that's about like a 10 or 12 inch diameter pot. Because I didn't want to transplant them. Grasses don't love being transplanted.
Right.
So they had to live there the whole summer. That's where they were going to be. And I was really wondering if the rice would make seed in time, you know, for the exhibit. So I put those in the sunniest spot with the most afternoon light. And then by the first week of July, the Palmin variety had sent up one spike. That's it. So I was watching it to see if any more would come. And that, like, weeks and weeks went by, nothing happened. So I was like, oh, my God, am I doing something wrong? Did I not water it enough? Did I not give it enough sun? What's wrong? Did I use the wrong soil? Finally, on the last day of August, which one was it?
Kodai Mai?
Yeah, it went out finally. Carolina Gold finally put out a spike, you know, and it was kind of slow to develop. And I was, so with Carolina Gold, I was able to really observe the process. And it's really, really interesting to see how rice develops because, you know, rice is a monocot. It doesn't have a flower per se. So the stem like swells up and then it like splits. This thing comes out like horizontally. And,
like a rhizome?
Yeah, and shoots out, and then it straightens, and then the seed swells, and then it turns into that beautiful characteristic, like, it's like hanging down, you know. So that was, like, really gratifying. I was like, wow, I kind of was happy to see Carolina Gold do that. And it was actually a really beautiful plant. I kind of want to...
Ornamentally, it's gorgeous.
Ornamentally, you know, and I bet if we put it in the actual ground rather than in a pot, it might be really beautiful. And that's the point of what Bree is also doing, is she's saying include food, you know, these cereal grains in your landscape because they're beautiful as well as edible. So I think Alice and I are going to get maybe a quarter cup of rice if the birds don't get it first, you know. So anyway, I have to give a shout out to all the rice farmers out there who do this, because it is intense. It's a very labor-intensive crop in the sense that it needs much more attention than wheat and rye and those other kinds of, you know, northern, western kind of crops. So that says something about the cultures, I think, that cultivate rice, you know? They got to be hardy. They got to be hardworking. It's just an interesting...
Well, they grow a lot of rice here in the United States, too. In the South and in the West Coast.
And people believe that Carolina Gold is the one that was brought over from West Africa with the slaves. So that's why it's, you know, that Carolina rice, that whole thing. So should we take a break? And then come back and talk about...
We'll talk about some of the other
the tropicals.
Plants. Yes.
So stay tuned. We're going to talk more about the Garden of Discovery and the other plants that we grew this summer in Brooklyn. We'll be right back.
And this one is called Burgundy by the Hollows. We'll be right back. The Joy of Sake invites you to the largest and liveliest sake tasting event in New York. With over 400 premium sakes to taste, including gold and silver award winners from the U.S. National Sake Appraisal and 16 of New York's top restaurants providing sake-licious appetizers. The event takes place on Friday, September 16th from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Metropolitan Pavilion on 18th Street. You'll be able to sip, savor, and experience a record 408 premium sakes, all in peak condition, with over half of them unavailable in the U.S. and exclusively for the Joy of Sake. All categories of sake will be represented, with over half from the elite Daiginjo sakes. Plus, nibble on sake-inspired appetizers, all carefully curated and perfectly paired with two creative poke stations by Narita and Sakamai, plus elegantly crafted appetizers from Sushi Nakazawa, Sakagura, Zuma, and more. Celebrate the world's finest sakes in an evening of sake perfection at the Joy of Sake. For more information, go to joyofsake.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking today about the Garden of Discovery exhibit that Carmen and I are putting together in Park Slope, Brooklyn, as kind of a offshoot, pardon the pun, of our radio show. And so we're growing all these great, crazy plants that we've been talking about for a long time. And we have signage, and we're inviting people to come and hang out with these plants, see what they look like, learn their stories, and engage with them. So that's the whole point.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the tropicals, because, you know, you can't have a Garden of Discovery without talking about tropical plants.
It's true. And if you have a shady garden, they're really underappreciated for that.
You're this is what gives you the color.
And textures that are amazing.
Yeah. So in my front stoop, I have planted quite an assortment of begonias and bananas and fuchsias and tradescantias and ferns and
coleus.
It's quite lush. We're going to be posting pictures on Facebook. And we've integrated the cotton, tobacco, and rice into this display.
Yeah.
So it is an odd assortment all about the age of discovery and plant exploration. So let's talk about begonias, because it's the biggest family and it's actually the centerpiece of the exhibit. It was described for the first time in 1690 by a French botanist, Charles Plumier, who named this family begonia of over 1,700 species after Michel Bigon, a fellow French botanist and governor of what is today Haiti. The first begonia reached Europe in 1777, and some cultivars date back to 14th century China. So this is a very old, beautiful plant. They are terrestrial, sometimes epiphytic, herbs or undershrubs, and they're thought to have their origins in Africa, but can also occur in subtropical and tropical moist climates in South and Central America, Africa, and Southern Asia. One of the most infamous plant hunting expeditions was led by a Scottish botanist named William Jack in the early 19th century. Jack's expedition was looking for begonias and other tropical plants on South Sumatra Island, and their search led them to a mountain the locals said was haunted. Not only was the ship with these specimens destroyed by a fire, but within a year, all the participants of the expedition were dead.
Now that's a good story.
That is a good story. So I'm so excited to tell that story on Halloween night as we're trick-or-treating and I'm handing out candy next to my begonia.
Yeah. Don't mess with Begonia Mountain. Begonia Mountain. That's going to be a Disney
begonia
movie.
Begonia Mountain.
Begonia Mountain.
I think I saw that as a kid. The National Garden Bureau has named 2016 the year of the begonia. Even though there are so many species, only a fraction of them are really in cultivation. Although many are from tropical parts of the world, new species such as Begonia grandis are now available to grow as perennials in the shade garden ornamental
section. And that's a great plant. That is,
it is.
Highly underutilized generally by the general public. And I think the reason people don't use it much is because when the average person goes shopping in Maine, they don't look like much in May.
No.
But if you ever want free plants that you don't have to take care of, plant one begonia grandis.
Uh-huh.
And it will spread like wildfire because they drop seed like crazy. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to do anything to it. Not even the slugs eat it.
Right. Right.
Really.
Right.
So it's great.
Most growers produce begonias from cuttings, considering that by weight, begonia seed is more expensive than gold.
Yep.
So the seed, which is as fine as dust, also makes production by seed very challenging. So the American Begonia Society, founded in 1932, holds the international database of plants, a virtual greenhouse, and tons of resources for begonia lovers. The society has local branches in 14 states, attesting to the continued popularity of the begonia. And Carmen mentioned earlier, I think a lot of people know begonias, but there's this truncated, kind of very static little waxy leaf begonia yeah. that every grandmother plants, and it is a great plant. We use it
too
when the condition calls for it, but this genre of plants is phenomenal.
Much more interesting,
so look into it, because the leaf color is amazing, the texture, the flowers, it is.
And if you want to be a phenomenal. True hipster, you cannot be one unless you join an obscure esoteric plant society. Okay. Either you have to join the Begonia Society.
Or the Indoor Plant Society.
The Indoor Plant
Society. A broader one.
Yeah. You'll meet a lot of interesting gray-haired friends, my friends, who know a lot about plants.
Yeah.
And these societies really welcome new members. You'll get free plants,
right.
you know.
And they need tech advice. It's a good marriage of millennials and seniors
combined with plant nerds. Perfect combo.
Yeah.
Just putting it out there.
And some great drinks.
Yeah.
Okay. Fuchsia, this is another plant that a lot of people know. It's a great tropical, but we have a question for you. What came first, the color, fuchsia, or the flower?
Mm-hmm.
So fuchsia is a genus of flowering plants that consists mostly of shrubs or small trees. The first, Fuchsia triphyllia, having bright orange blooms in Santo Domingo, was discovered on the Caribbean island of Hispaniola, which is Haiti in the Dominican Republic, about 1696 to 1697 by the French monk and botanist Charles Plumier.
There he is again.
There he is.
You know, wasn't he supposed to be converting people? What's he going around botanizing? He got bored, you know?
Yeah, enough with the mind games.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just going to go into the bush.
Look at these plants. During his third expedition to the Greater Antilles. In 1703, Father Plumier published information on this new plant under the name of Fuchsia triphyllia flora cocciana, three-leafed flowering plant with red berries. He named the new genus after the renowned 16th century German botanist and physician Leonhard Fuchs.
Fuchs is important to know. We've talked about Fuchs.
Yes. So here he is. Fuchs was the author of a very early herbal manuscript, which included high-quality drawings and woodcuts as the most telling way to specify what a plant name stands for. Throughout the 19th century, plant-collecting fever spread throughout Europe and the United States, and many species of numerous genera were introduced. Some as living plants, others as seed, and fuchsia became enormously popular during that era, because it is so adaptable.
Yeah, and also can tolerate shade like
shade.
The begonia.
Right.
And now there's many varieties available of that, too.
So fuchsia was first introduced into England by a sailor who grew it in a window where it was observed by a nurseryman from Hammersmith, a Mr. Lee, who succeeded in buying it and propagating it for the trade. And this was supposedly either one of the short-tubed species, such as Fuchsia magelliana or...
Magellanica,
mm-hmm. sorry, or Fuchsia...
Cochinea.
Cochinea. Thank you. I can't read my handwriting. The color fuchsia was first introduced as the color of a new aniline dye called fuchsine, patented in 1859 by the French chemist François-Emmanuel Vergien, V-E-R-G-U-I-N.
These French names are tongue twisters, man.
Yes, they are. So the dye was renamed magenta later in the same year to celebrate a victory of the French army at the Battle of Magenta on June 4, 1859, near the Italian city of that same name. The first recorded use of fuchsia as a color name was in England in 1892. On computer screens, red and blue combined light at full intensity produce fuchsia or magenta, and the two web colors are identical and have the same color code.
Now, we have had, Alice and I have had some interesting conversations with a client who will remain nameless about what fuchsia is. And what's magenta. I mean, we have had deep conversations when we're trying to pick, you know, impatient color.
To describe.
Is that fuchsia?
Yeah.
Or is it magenta?
Yeah. Is it purple or is it pink?
Pink.
Is it blue? What's the intensity of the color?
And this matters
blue?
Because here's what happens. You take a picture of the fuchsia, of the plant, and then with your phone, you send it to them. They open it on their screen, and they think it's a different tone.
Right. Everybody's screens are set differently.
So
luckily, good old Q produced this flower guide.
Yes.
And it's basically the Pantone guide to
every color.
Colors.
Yeah.
So it's a very good tool, reference tool, and it's available at the Q Garden Shop website.
Yeah, so, that's a cool thing.
So we got it, and now we're all on the same page about what fuchsia is.
And what it's not.
Right. So another really great plant that we have in the exhibit is Tradescantia palladia.
Great plant.
Pupurea, from weed to window box. So this is one of our favorite plants. We use it all the time for a pop of color. Tradescantia pallida, synonymous with Cetrisia purpurea, is native to Mexico. This is the purple leaf
wandering Jew
plant. In tropical and semi-tropical areas, it is commonly grown outdoors as a ground cover. It's commonly called also purple heart. Purpurea, sometimes sold as purple heart, is a cultivar that features purple foliage, which is superior to that of the species. It has served for a number of years as a vigorous and a very attractive houseplant.
Yep.
Your grandmother probably grew it.
Along with the spider plant.
That's right. But it's now being increasingly used in outdoor garden applications as a ground cover and a great container plant additive. As a house plant, Tradescantia pallida has been judged exceptionally effective at improving indoor air quality by filtering out volatile organic compounds, a class of common pollutants and respiratory irritants via a process known as phytoremediation.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, we use it mostly outdoors. Mm-hmm. And I want to add that
I actually bring it in every year and plant
really?
It.
Really? Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's super easy to grow. Mm-hmm. It's one of those, like, pretty much bulletproof plants. If you want the dark splash of purple, it's great with silver.
Right, and chartreuse.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. We posted a picture of it. Alice planted the green, like, the chartreuse variety of
Tradescantia.
And the purpurea together, and that's a great combo.
Mm-hmm. Kind of hurts your eyes to look at, but that's what's great about it.
Right.
So Edward Palmer, 1829 to 1911, was the first European to observe and assign a Latin name to the type of specimen near Ciudad Victoria in 1907. Palmer was a self-taught English botanist and an early American archaeologist who collected natural specimens, primarily plants, for the Smithsonian Institution and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He collected specimens in the southwestern United States, in Florida and Mexico, including Baja California and South America, and had about 200 species and two genera of plants named after him, Palmariella and Malperia.
That's interesting.
So these botanical collections, which number over 100,000, are mostly pressed and dried, and they reside at research institutions all around the world. The Palmer Botanical Collection in the U.S. National Herbarium at the Smithsonian remains the largest, containing over 16,000 specimens that he collected over 60 years. He wrote a report, Food Products of the North American Indians, in 1871, which was one of the pioneering works in ethnobotany, and collected specimens of 24 of the 61 plant species described with their uses in the report.
Now imagine this. This is what during the Western expansion.
Right.
And here's this guy working for the USDA, mm-hmm. I guess the beginning of the USDA, mm-hmm. thinking like he was 100 years ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't intend for him to go do that, you know, but he kind of did it. You know, he kind of went off just like the French.
I was going to say just like the
Jesuits.
Right.
They're supposed to be converting. Yeah. And there he is going off
botanizing.
And this, well, thank God this guy did, mm-hmm. you know, because imagine collecting 100,000 specimens. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
That's, you know, obsessive.
Yeah.
So these Tradescantia plants were introduced into Europe as ornamental plants in the 17th century and are now grown in as many parts of the world. The Chameleon brothers discovered this family of plants. And the genus name refers to John Tradescant the first and his son John Tradescant the second. So this is a time period of 1570 to 1662. Both the father and the son were botanists and successive gardeners to Charles the First.
Hey, and if you want to see a cool painting mm-hmm. of an early botanist, I don't know if it's the first or the second Tradescant, but there's a great painting. I forget who the painter was, but he probably was Dutch, if I was going to guess, of one of the John Tradescants. It's really great. It's a really beautiful painting. He's got like a pirate earring, you know, and he's holding a flower. It's a very, very cool early painting.
Okay, so
last but not least,
the kind of creme de la creme,
yes,
piece,
yes,
is the banana. Now I have this tropical banana in my Brooklyn front yard.
It's awesome.
And when I was planting it, I said to my son, "Do you know what this is?" And he thought, "Oh, just another leafy plant that my mom brought home." And I said, "Son, this is a banana. This is a banana plant. This is what you eat every morning, seriously." So now when you ask him what the plant is, he says, "It's a banana, seriously." he thinks that's the name of it.
The full
banana
name, seriously. Banana seriously.
So it is an edible fruit. Botanically, it's a berry produced by several kinds of large herbaceous flowering plants in the genus Musa, M-U-S-A. In some countries, bananas that are used for cooking are also called plantains. The fruits grow in clusters hanging from the top of the plant. Almost all modern edible parthenocarpic seedless bananas come from two wild species, Musa acuminata and Musa balbiciana. Musa species are native to tropical Indo-Malaysia and Australia, and are likely to have been first domesticated in Papua New Guinea. They are grown in at least 107 countries, primarily for their fruit and to a lesser extent to make fiber. Banana wine and banana beer are also made, as are its use as an ornamental
plant.
Which is how we're
don't expect to get bananas.
We are not going to get a banana from this.
Yeah.
The banana may also have been present in isolated locations in the Middle East on the eve of Islam. The spread of Islam was followed by far-reaching spread of the banana. By the 10th century, the banana appears in texts from Palestine and Egypt, and from there it diffused into North Africa and Muslim Iberia. During the medieval ages, bananas from Granada were considered among the best in the Arab world. In 650, Islamic conquerors brought the banana to Palestine. In fact, it is thought that the word banana comes from the Arabic word banan, meaning finger. Bananas were introduced into the Americas by the Portuguese sailors who brought the fruits from West Africa in the 16th century. Not long after the arrival of sugar via Columbus, the island of Hispaniola receives a consignment of banana plants, long cultivated in tropical Asia. These become an important part of the economy of Latin America, leading to monopolies and to the pejorative term Banana Republic.
Not the clothing store.
It's just going to
The clothing store.
The clothing store, Banana Republic, you started as like
travel.
Exploration clothes.
Yeah, travel. Right. It's gone very far from that.
And it's really sad because it was the original purveyor of cargo pants.
Yes, it was.
And like cargo vests.
And camouflage.
And camouflage.
And Panama hats.
So this was like 1980s. Right?
Yeah, early 80s. Yeah, because I remember the one in the West Village going in there, just loving it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like... But now,
back when Pier 1 was the original Pier 1.
Yeah, but Banana Republic now is nothing to do with bananas.
Unfortunately. So in the 1820s and the 1830s, British botanists in the United Kingdom's overseas colonies became fascinated with the banana plant and the fruit. Englishman Charles Taillefer, enamored with bananas that he encountered on his journeys around the Indian Ocean and China, began a collection of plantain plants on the island. How do you pronounce this?
Mauritius.
I can never pronounce that. I actually have a friend from there, and I'm always like, ugh. He says it a million times, and I still can't get it. In 1829, he shipped a couple of banana plants to an acquaintance in England, where they eventually passed into the hands of the 7th Duke of Devonshire, William Cavendish, upon his acquaintance's passing. Cavendish was able to cultivate the plants, and the Cavendish banana was formally recognized as a cultivar in 1836. From England, the cultivar was subsequently diffused back into the tropical zones. So the bananas that you find in the average U.S. grocery store are pretty much the same as they were in the 19th century. The genetic variety known as Cavendish, which is cultivated for commercial markets. This large agro-monoculture approach is susceptible to wildly spreading fungus, Tropical Race 4, which has decimated an earlier species in the 1950s. Plant breeding programs are quickly working to replace Cavendish with a new variety and introduction to avoid another banana calamity.
Well, it's a serious thing because this is an example of not, you know, this one tastes good. It ships well. And so now they have to figure it out. Otherwise, you're not going to have banana bread. You're not going to have banana pancakes.
No.
And the banana is very interesting. I mean, you can read up on this. It is such an important plant economically. Uh-huh. It has influenced politics all over Central and South America mm-hmm. and the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And it's really worth learning more about.
It really is. There was actually a great NPR show about this a couple of years ago that I highly recommend people look into because it does a great job of explaining this Tropical Race 4 disease and what they're doing subsequently to.
Because imagine not being able to. It's big.
It's huge. Know? I mean, the whole world lives on bananas. It affects
and
the
it's
entire
kind of the,
world.
Like perfect food.
It has the potassium.
It has sugar. It has a little bit of fiber.
And what's great about it is that it can plug you up when you need to be plugged up, and it can get things going when you need to get.
And if you need a laugh, what are you going to do without a banana?
How are you going to fall down on the street?
The Marx Brothers, we're not slipping on apple peels,
Anyway, so we have all these great plants, and they're all featured in our Garden of Discovery exhibit, which is at the front of my brownstone, 550 11th Street in Park Slope, between 7th and 8th Avenue, starting September 17th, and will continue to the end of October. So not only do we have these plants, we have amazing signage, and there are scannable
QR codes.
Mm-hmm. QR codes. So you can learn a lot more information as you're hanging out and looking at these plants. If you're in NYC, you can come and look at these plants. We'll also be posting things on Facebook and on our Instagram account if you're not in NYC. And you can also visit our newly launched WeDigPlantsPodcast.com website and blog to see what we're doing.
Yeah, we're going to kind of make that our hub. It's in construction, so that it's going to be evolving a little bit. So the first things that are going to be on the blog are going to be about these 7 plants.
Mm-hmm.
Lots more photos. You can see the rice as babies. You can see a lot more of what we talked about, because Alice and I wanted to add a visual component to our audio component.
Exactly.
You know?
So We also want to share with you some other good news. We Dig Plants has won 2 awards this year from the Garden Writers Association.
Woohoo! 3 years running.
3 years running. We've won a silver award for best podcast series overall and for our radio program, Talents.
Yeah.
So we're so thrilled to be recognized by our peers for these 3 years. And I don't know if you realize this, but we have had another kind of pseudo underground project going on that we just won 2 silver awards for. We've been working with an illustrator, Gideon Kendall, to illustrate some of our stories, and the series is called The Thistle and Fig Tales. It was printed this year in Pith and Vigor, which is our friend Rochelle Gruyere. She's the editor and owner of the Pith and Vigor magazine, and she gave us an opportunity to publish these stories in her newspaper, and we won some awards. So that was really great, and hopefully we can expand this series. Thistle and Fig Tales series. We've got a lot of ideas that we would love to work with Gideon on to get these stories out in the
public. And it's really nice to add it's a format of a kind of like a graphic novel comic. Uh-huh. So it adds a really interesting visual component to mm-hmm. what we're talking about here. It's
yeah.
fun. And we're Thistle and Fig.
Yes.
You know.
Can you guess who's who?
You have to look on the website to see the picture. You'll figure it out.
So we're excited to be back. We're excited to launch this exhibit. We're excited to interact with you via our website. And we do have a Gmail account now. Mm-hmm. So you guys can contact us directly. And what else?
Compliments only, by the way. We don't want to hear complaints. Only compliments and stuff like
no,
that.
No, we do want to hear your complaints. Because
and your ideas.
And we learn a lot. Actually, yeah, we do learn a lot from all kinds of criticism, so keep it coming. We have a great season lined up with lots of stories and lots of interesting guests and topics, ranging from how politics affect public and community gardens to how plants of the immigrants and slaves shaped American cuisine. We have some tech shows coming up.
Yeah.
We have some botanical art shows coming up. It's going to be a good year.
Yeah. New stuff.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening. The show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to check out our new blog, as Alice said, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com. You can also check us out on Twitter.
At WeDigPlants.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of connect everything. Stay in touch with us. Thanks for listening, and see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.